I'm sure. Okay, exchange the tests if you have not already done so. And we will correct these as quickly as possible, trying to make it the least painful. Class. Thank you. All of a sudden, I just felt like I lost control of my students. Question number one. Which of the following statements accurately describes British Israelism? Letter E, theological theory that transcends denominational boundaries. Number two, where did it originate? Letter C, England. According to its proponents, who founded it? Obviously, letter B, Abraham. Number four, according to its critics, who founded it? Letter B, Richard Brothers, the deranged Navy man who went insane. Pardon? There's a lot of demons lurking there, that's for sure. Number five, when did British Israelism actually begin? Letter C, 18th century. Number six, who is the most widely heard proponent? Letter A, Herbert W. Number seven, how many are there? About 3 million of them. Letter D. Number eight, what area of the world is the stronghold? Letter C, England. Number nine, what is the one fundamental error of British Israelism? Letter D, misidentification of the tribes of Ephraim and Manasseh. Number 10, what area of theology is affected by the fundamental error of British Israelism? Letter B, prophecy regarding Israel. Number 11, according to British Israelism, who is Ephraim? Letter E, England. Number 12, who is Manasseh? Letter D, America. Number 13, according to British Israelism, what happened to the 10 tribes after their captivity? Letter E, intermarried with their captors and with the Gentile inhabitants of the land as they migrated westward, thus losing their identity. Number 14, according to British Israelism, who were the descendants of the lost 10 tribes? Letter B, Anglo-Saxons. Number 15, how does British Israelism interpret Bible prophecies of the regathering of both Judah and Israel? And this is the point that I made that just seems, how can this be? But it's what they teach. The answer is letter B, that they will be literally regathered to Palestine. But how they come up with that, based on all the other things they teach, I don't have the slightest idea. Number 16, where does the scripture teach most clearly and emphatically that Israel will again be saved nationally? Letter C, Romans chapter 11. Number 17, which of the following groups constitutes the Jewish people? Letter C, Levi, Judah, Benjamin. Number 18, what intermarriage resulted in the Samaritan race? Letter D, those of Israel who were not taken captive, intermarrying with Gentile immigrants from Assyria. Number 19, in what year was the nation of Israel divided? Letter C, 931. And who was the first king of the northern kingdom? Letter B, Jeroboam. Number 21, how many and what type of kings ruled northern Israel? Letter A, 19, all evil. Number 22, who took northern Israel captive and what year did this occur? Letter B, Assyria, 721 BC. Number 23, when did northern Israel return to Palestine? Trick question. Letter E, none of the above. Number 24, who is the first king of southern Judah following the split? Letter C, Rehoboam. How many and what type of kings? Letter C, 20, some evil, some good. Who took southern Judah captive, and what year did this occur? Letter B, Babylonia, 606 BC. When did southern Judah return to Palestine? And that's letter C, 536. Number 28, why did the nation divide? Letter B, Rehoboam increased the already burdensome tax, so they rebelled. Number 29, what eventually happened to the northern 10 tribes? Letter C, they scattered across Europe. Number 30. According to British Israelism, what is the sole basis by which nations can be assured safety from total destruction? Letter E. The nation must be the literal seed of national Israel, which is so totally non-biblical, anti-biblical. It's just really incomprehensible. Check all that apply. Number one, which of the following groups contain members that hold the doctrine of British Israelism? Letter A, Anglicans. E, Evangelical denominations. F, Pentecostals. G, Seventh-day Adventists. And I, Worldwide Church of God. A, E, F, G, I. No Baptists. Nope. No Baha'i. No Unitarians. And no Community Chapelites. Right? That's good. Gonna pass that on to the pastor. It'll make him feel a lot better. It'd be terrible after I taught this section that you all believe in British Israelism. He'd wonder what I'm doing here. I would be wondering myself. Number two, which of the following ministers advocate British Israelism or advocated? A, Garner Ted. B, Herbert W. Father-son tandem there. Richard Brothers, letter D. And we all checked Herman. You've got to have Richard Brothers down there.
Was he a minister?
Oh, we are really getting technical, aren't we? We are really reading. If you really read it that carefully, and with your thinking of what a minister is, if you really read it that way, I'll let you have it blank or checked, so I'm not going to argue with that. But it meant in a looser sense. I mean, you're really, every word, I think we may need some deliverance here. Yes. Oh, that's right. At Russ, you never know what to expect from him. Okay, so check D or don't check D. Everybody checked F, and I don't know who Herman Ho is. I looked all throughout Russ's notes. I could not find that anywhere on planet Earth, but it's checked in his key, and so I assume that it's checked correctly. But you also need to check letters G and H, James Lovell and Howard Rand. We're not going to carry this on. I will give you letter D. But we talked about these as men with publications and with radio ministries, and so they're ministers. I can see the question about Richard Brothers, and I can accept that, but I won't accept it for the other two. No, the problem is, number one, I never mentioned him. Number two, you assume that because some Seventh-day Adventists are British Israelists, that because HMS Richards is a Seventh-day Adventist, therefore he's also. No, I didn't. Knew. I really didn't. I almost did, but I didn't. No, I didn't even think of his name. And then you all got number three correct, so. And just one last point there. As far as I know, Lovell and Rand were properly ministers, so as far as I know. And I am sorry for the confusion on that, but we just can't give you all of those. Number four, which of the following are taught in class as Bible facts? Letters A through F are checked, and H and I are checked. A through F, H and I. A through F, H and I. So the only two that aren't would be letters G and J. Now, number five. The ones that are checked concerning proper application for the name Jews, N, O, Q, R, and X. None of the others are checked. So N, O, Q, R, and X. Yes? Okay, the tribe of Judah, Judah's sons, and their offsprings. Now, see, first of all, you go back to Jacob, and he becomes Israel. And then you have Judah born, and then his sons. But only his sons after the captivity, or in the captivity, are Jews. So, oh no, not at all, not at all. He's way back there in, well, he's before 1500 BC. He's back there in Egypt. And see, now, part would be, but part aren't. And so you can't have, you know, a 50-50 answer and put it down as being Jews. Some of them are Jews, but some aren't because they live prior to the captivity. Okay, then question six concerning Israel. Easiest to tell you which ones aren't checked because the vast majority are. A and B are not checked. Abraham and Abraham's children. See, some of Abraham's children are, some aren't. And so you can't check that as being Israel. And then letter T is not, because some of the inhabitants of Palestine were Samaritans. Who knows who else from time to time were there. So all the inhabitants. Palestine is a certain location, and even at the time of Christ, Palestine is from Galilee to Judea, and right in the middle, you've got the Samaritans, and that's Palestine. Palestine is the land of Canaan, and so all those that have lived in Palestine or in the land of Canaan, just very simply, aren't all Israelites. They just haven't been. And they're not even that way today because there's Arabs and all sorts of other people living there. So I can see what you're saying, but when it says Palestine, it's talking about the land, and it says Bible days, and so that's covering a huge span of time. And so you have this area of land. And see, I suppose there are some people that might think that way, that everybody who's ever lived in Palestine must be an Israelite. But historically, we find that there have been all sorts of people that have lived in that land. So we're talking about a specific location, and then we're giving a time frame to it. And you can look at all sorts of different points in time, historically, in that time frame where there have been a lot of non-Israelites there. So that's how it has to be viewed. Letter V is not checked. And then letter W is not checked. And that's it. So A, B, T, V, W. And everything else is checked. It's called the millennium. I did have that noted to tell you that. So I will accept L checked or not. But that's what it is talking about. It's talking about the millennium. So that's kind of confusing. Is just a few other points on the test are. So yes, Jill. Yep.
No.
They are Israel out there, whether we know them or not, because they're still of the bloodline. God knows them. And when he calls the 144,000, he's not going to have any trouble at all. And he's going to be able to, as far as we can tell, from what is stated, reveal to them exactly who they are. And so they're Israel. Even though they've lost identity, the bloodline has been maintained. Yep.
Mm-hmm. Aren't
they? It is on mine. Did I tell you that it wasn't checked?
No.
It is checked. X is checked. Yep. See? You thought that through just perfectly. Well done. Okay. This is so much fun. Question number 7. Which of the following were taught in class as proper interpretations or applications of prophecies directed to national Israel? And everyone is checked except I and J. Everyone is checked except I and J. So A through H, all checked. Number 9, since everybody got question 8 correct. Question 9, concerning this coronation stone, check D, E, and I. Jacob's pillow, Moses' rock, and the stone brought to the British Isles by Jeremiah. You betcha. But I know I did. It was such a wonderful revelation to bring. I don't know why I didn't take more time, but I did tell you that. I don't know what I said. D-E-I. That's didn't spell anything, but yes. Well, eight was E and F. Yep. 10. Sure was. Yep, 10 was given. See, now I'm all confused here as to where we are. We just finished 9. We're on 10. 10 was given. Ah, now we're on 11. There we go. According to British Israelism, which of the following Bible prophecies are literally fulfilled in America and or Britain? Everyone is checked except G. Everyone is checked except G. Now, I really don't know why Russ didn't deal with G in his notes. If Nathan's prophecy that David's throne would be established forever is used by British Israelists, I must admit, logically, it would seem like Ezekiel's prophecies. But I don't know, and I didn't present it in class, and so that's all I can say about it. And if you checked it because it seemed logical that it should be checked, I can agree 100%, except for one thing. You still get it wrong. But I don't know. I do not know why that's not checked. I don't know why it wouldn't be part of their theology. It would seem to make sense that it would be. But Russ didn't have anything about it in his notes, and that's all I can say about it. Number 12, which of the following are false concepts used by anti-British Israel teachers in an attempt to refute British Israel theology? You need to check every single one. And, of course, from letters A through J, you're going to have contradictory points. But we're just talking about all anti-British Israelists, and they come up with some pretty wild reasons why British Israelism can't be true. So it's A through J. And number 13, What are the proper scriptural views? You want to make sure that you've checked A through H. So you used up quite a bit of ink on these. So everything is checked for questions 12 and 13. Now the short answer, I would imagine we've got some pretty amazing answers on this. We'll see how it goes. If it gets too complicated, we'll round file the students and keep the tests. No, that's not what I meant. We'll figure out something. Number one, why was the 10-tribe northern nation called Israel? You only need to have one answer. There's basically two answers. Number one, they were all from Israel. So that's one reason. And number two, why they were called Israel is because they had the majority of the tribes. So those were the things presented. I'm sure that you might have come up with other things to present, but those are the two basic points. Read their answer, and we're not here to deal with all sorts of far-fetched possibilities. So no, it's only one point, and you don't multiply the points. So it's just subtracted right from 100, so it's not that big of a thing. Number two, why was the 10-tribe northern nation called Ephraim? Two reasons. You can have either one. Number one, Ephraim was the largest tribe. And number two, the first king, Jeroboam, came from Ephraim. So because it was the largest tribe and the first king came from Ephraim, that's the reasons why. So you can have either one of those. Number three, why was the 10-tribe northern nation called Samaria? Because that was the capital city. If they just say that it was the main city or the largest city, that misses the point. It's because it was the capital city. And they really need to say that. That's the reason. Number four, why was the 3-tribe southern nation called Judah? Two reasons. You only need one. Judah was the largest tribe, and also the first king, Rehoboam, was from Judah. So because it was the largest tribe, first king from it, that's why it was called Judah. Why was the 3-tribe southern nation called Jerusalem? It's because it was the capital city. Just like the northern kingdom called Samaria, so the southern kingdom also, from time to time, called Jerusalem. It's used representing that whole southern kingdom because it was the capital city. And then number six, why was the 3-tribe southern nation called Jews? Number one, because Babylon named them this in captivity. It became the term that the Babylonians used to describe the captives from Judah. And so they became known as Jews. So it's how the Babylonians named them in captivity. And the second reason, and I don't remember mentioning this in class, I may have, but here is a second reason. Because they were the principal inhabitants of Judea, that's what the area was known as, and Jews, by definition, means those from Judea. And so it may have even been used at other times as kind of a looser term, talking about those from Judea. I don't really know on that. That seems to be what the point is, but I'm not really certain of that. The only thing I ever really knew about it was that it was the name coined and developed while they're in captivity. So, for six? I'll take that. That would be the same thing as the second point, so that'd be fine. Because it was the largest tribe, and so then you'd have this term Jews talking about the largest tribe, and then the largest tribe would stand as representative for the entire southern kingdom. Therefore, you could call them all Jews, those of Judea. So that would be the same thing. I couldn't hear you. They were doing so well. were doing so well until they started talking about Jerusalem. And it's pretty hard to give a quarter point. So we'll have to count it wrong. It's not. It has nothing to do with Jerusalem. So we'll have to count that wrong. Everything else was just fine. It was just so good up to that point. And then the last one, why was the three-tribe southern nation called Israel after its return? Number one, because they are from Jacob. That means they are from Israel. So they are still Israelites. So therefore, they are Israel. That's one point. Number two, the southern kingdom, after they return, does have members of all 13 tribes. So they stand as representative for all of Israel. Therefore, you can call them Israel. And then number three, it's because this is all that's left of Israel. So therefore, this is Israel. So that's how you can view it, describe it. Yes. You have to talk loud. No. So add up the minus, subtract from 100. Yeah, I'll take that. I'll take that. Yes? What did they say? Well, what did they say for number five? Well, that's a good question. I'll just take it as chief city. That's fine.
Number three, two.
Just five. My benevolence stopped on number five. Yeah, and then subtract from 100. It's one good thing. We're not going to ever see this test again. Yeah. Pardon? Okay, I'll just correct it. Thanks, Ruth. Did you add up the other minus points? 20 up to this, right? So he's missed 20, not including this. Okay. Once you have the scores recorded, then pass them in. Yeah, if you put the minus at the top and subtract it from 100, please. Page 2? It's B. B. We're going to start on Calvinism. And I hope this proves to be a little bit better than British Israelism. And here's the don't try to weigh me down with such things. I don't know. I don't know what it has to do with it. It may be on there just to fill up the back page. No, I really don't know. I did not take a Well, that's good. Maybe we were just trying to supply something that would be of help. Well, I don't know what it is, why it's there. I have no idea. Okay, what we want to do first is give some overall history to Calvinism. And this involves what is known as the 5 points of Calvinism. And it's not that Calvin himself or Augustine, who were more the originators of this, ever put it in a 5-point form. But because of certain events later, we come up with the 5 points of Calvinism.
I have a quick question before we get started. You know, sometimes you hear Calvin mentioned as one of the great reformers.
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. Then again, that you see, like in this class of Victorian doctrine, and maybe
he was a great reformer. He was a good man of God, and he was probably the greatest theologian at that time in history. And things that he wrote, his commentary has many, many good points in it. And it's really quite a valuable source. So the man had a lot of understanding. He had a lot of ability, but he also had some wrong concepts. So he was a very good man of God. He had his problems, his weaknesses, his doctrinal errors, but he was a tremendous reformer, and God really used him. So we don't want to look at Calvinism and then end up with a real negative feeling toward John Calvin. We don't want that. That's not the purpose of this. And we don't want that toward Calvinists today either, because there have been many, many Calvinists that have been tremendous men of God. And there are many today that are doing good works for God. They just happen to have a demonic doctrine. And that's exactly what it is. And that's how they hold it. I am so convinced. I cannot really express how convinced I am. And it comes to me every single time we start on a new topic as to how people can hold these doctrines. Because these doctrines have nothing really to do with the Scriptures. And here are people who are supposed to be Bible-believing, and they hold these doctrines. And as far as I'm concerned, there's only one way, because they were men of good hearts, good motives, good conscience, loved God, wanted God, served God, studied the Bible, prayed. How could they end up with these false doctrines? Demonic spirits tricked them. And I am absolutely convinced of that. And Calvin was tricked. And there's a lot of things undoubtedly in his background and what he imbibed in Catholicism that gave the devil this advantage over him, but he was a good man and he really loved God and he did a tremendous work for God. So you want to have a very positive view of John Calvin, and I think that's very important. See, Luther was a believer in predestination, so in a loose sense he was a Calvinist, although that term really didn't come in John Calvin's day. And everybody thinks of him in a very positive vein. It just happens that this doctrine of predestination has been labeled Calvinism. So then if you study the doctrine of Calvinism and find out that it's an error, there would be a tendency for most people to end up feeling negative toward Calvin himself. But that's improper. That's an improper thing. And right now, John Calvin isn't a Calvinist. He's straightened out. He's in a lot different place. He wouldn't burn Michael Servetus again either. He burned Michael Servetus at the stake because Michael Servetus didn't believe in the Trinity. So he was a tad bit intolerant. Just a bit. But he was committed. And he followed through with what he believed. And that is something to commend him for, even though he was erroneous. If we had, in a sense, the same determination and would put the same effort of expending our energy and really putting ourselves into what we believe, like Calvin did, Community Chapel would have to be rebuilding and adding more rooms and more sanctuary space about every 6 months. So Calvin was a good man, and he loved God. And he put his whole heart into this, and he accomplished a great deal. So I want to have a positive view of him. Okay, so now the story of these 5 points begins in the 4th to 5th century with Augustine, or Augustine, however it's exactly to be pronounced. We will say Augustine, since that's normally how it's pronounced. And Augustine lived from 354 to 430. And he was the prominent bishop of Hippo, H-I-P-P-O, in North Africa. And he's the one who originated and taught the basic points of this theological system. And as I mentioned, it didn't begin with just these 5 points, but this came about later in history. Now, Augustine was opposed by a man named Pelagius, P-E-L-A-G-I-U-S. Pelagius lived from about 360 to about 420. He was a theologian and a monk who visited Rome. And he was a British theologian, so he came from England, and he was a theologian, and he was a monk, he was a Catholic, and he came to Rome to see what the Holy City was like. And you don't have a fully developed Roman Catholicism at this time, but it's on its way, and the basic foundation is well established. So he came to Rome, and much like Luther, he saw the corruption. And so he immediately began to refute the doctrines of Augustine. And that's because he could see that the fruit on the tree was not good. So it caused him to be very much concerned with the theological system that was producing the fruit. And that's what everybody should be able to see. Everybody should be able to go up to a tree and say, "These apples are rotten." Everybody should be able to see that. Or go up to the tree and say, "This tree's dead." There shouldn't be a soul on planet Earth that can't see that. You don't have any problem going up to viewing an actual tree in your backyard and saying, "This tree's dead." Or taking the fruit down and saying, "But this is filled with worms." Or, "These apples laying on the ground are rotten." Nobody has any difficulty making that kind of an assessment. But when it comes to religion and to denominations, they can't tell the difference between a living tree, a dead tree, good fruit, bad fruit. But this man could see that there was a real problem there in Rome. And so it caused him to really question the system behind it, the theology behind it. This man originated the saying, "If I ought, I can." If I ought, meaning if I ought to do something, if something is right, then I can do it. And that's true, with God's power and by God's grace. If there's something that we ought to do, we can do it through Jesus Christ, who will strengthen us. "I can do all things through Christ Jesus that strengtheneth me." That's what the scripture says. And he started to see that man had a free will. And this was in direct opposition to Augustine's doctrine that man's will is bound. Now, there's quite a number of different points involved in all of this, and by the time we get all the way finished, hopefully we will have been able to address them all and clarify them. There are those believing in Calvinism and in what Augustine taught, that man's will is bound But that's prior to regeneration. And then after he's regenerated, then his will is not in the same bound state. So that's a thing that we'll run across in this study as well. And that's essentially what Augustine believed. He believed that man's will is bound prior to regeneration. And then after being regenerated, his will would be in a different place and would have, in a sense, and I believe with qualification, a free will. But Pelagius said that's not true. That's not true. Man has a free will before regeneration. And so he directly opposed Augustine. Pelagius also denied original sin. And he affirmed man's ability to exercise his free will to believe as well as to have faith in God. So whether or not Pelagius was born again or whether or not he was really a Christian, we don't know. But he did have some good understanding. Now, he was condemned as a heretic by the Roman Catholic Church in 416. So they did not tolerate his doctrine very long. Now, their definition of a heretic is someone who doesn't believe like they do. That is a terribly improper definition of a heretic. That would be like us labeling every Lutheran, Baptist, Methodist, Presbyterian, Pentecostal, you name it, as heretics because they don't believe exactly like we do. That is utterly ridiculous. That misses the whole point of a proper definition to who is a heretic and what constitutes heresy. The true definition, again, gets back to those who are denying the essential doctrines for salvation. That's what determines a cult, and that's what determines a heretic, as far as in the truest sense. And now there are times that a church puts people out who are saved, but they won't walk in step. I suppose in a loose sense, we could call that person a heretic, because he's not walking in submission, he's not walking in accord with the church government and with a particular body of Christ, but that really would not be a proper way to describe him. We don't announce in the bulletin that we have put out three more heretics. That really wouldn't be a right way of describing it. Heresy involves the doctrines of salvation and them being denied, twisted, perverted, misused, so that from those people, as they're ministering, people cannot get saved. They cannot get saved through their doctrine, through their teaching. That's what a heretic is. So it involves the doctrines of salvation. And to describe Pelagius as a heretic is completely wrong. And anybody that the Roman Catholic Church described as a heretic, in about 95% of the cases, you know they weren't heretics. Now, there were some that they described as heretics that truly were. People like Arius, and some of the others there in the formulation of the doctrine of the Trinity, and people who weren't even saved. They were just philosophers, and they had a different philosophy than what was being formed by the various bishops that were building the Roman Catholic Church. And so those people were heretics, but for the most part, they weren't. There were a lot of people who wanted God and were living for God that the Catholic Church put right out, labeled as a heretic, and they were not heretics. Now, the doctrines of Augustine were imbibed by Roman Catholicism, and they were believed by that system for a millennium of darkness, until the days of the Protestant Reformation. Now, the foremost 16th century Protestant reformers, that's the reformers in the 1500s, continued to believe these particular doctrines, even though they were coming out of the Catholic Church. And the reason is because they were coming out of the Catholic Church, meaning that they had been in the Catholic Church, they had been Roman Catholic clergy, and really the Protestant Reformation in the 16th century did not bring them that far out of Catholicism. And that's what God is still dealing with in the Church, even at this present time. That's what we see concerning the doctrine of the Trinity and all sorts of other things. They're Catholic doctrines. There are many things still held in the church, and they're Catholic doctrines. And God is trying to get all of those things out. So that means Luther, Zwingli, Z-W-I-N-G-L-I, Knox, K-N-O-X, Beza, B-E-Z-A, and of course Calvin, all continue to be believers in the theological system developed by Augustine, predestination, involving eternal security and all these other things. And they had inherited this theology from the Roman Catholic background, and they just were not able to shake certain things. And Calvin was the one primarily responsible for carrying the doctrine of the Trinity from the Catholic Church to the Protestant Church. So Calvin loaded up his suitcase with a lot of things that he should have left back there in the baggage section and gone on to better things, but unfortunately he brought these things along into the Protestant Church. Now, another man involved here is Erasmus. E-R-A-S-M-U-S, Erasmus. And he lived from 1466 to 1536. Now Erasmus was a Dutch humanist and theologian. And he never left the Catholic Church. But he did seek to assert in his teachings man's free will. It's really quite an amazing thing. Here's Erasmus. He's a humanist and a theologian and a Roman Catholic, and he begins to teach about man's free will. Now, Martin Luther and Erasmus had a number of debates, and whether or not they were direct debates or not, I don't really know. Whether they had that much direct contact, I don't know. But Luther would say things, Erasmus would say things, and they were at odds with one another, because Luther, he believed in the bondage of the human will. The man does not have a free will. And that was the title of the book, or the pamphlet that he wrote, to rebut what Erasmus had written, which he titled The Freedom of the Will. So Erasmus writes The Freedom of the Will, and Luther responds with The Bondage of the Will. And so it made things during this 16th century very, very interesting. If it all could have been carried on through the newspapers and the television and all that, it would have made each evening, there would have been some very interesting highlights to the latest go-rounds theologically. And they traded quite a bit of biting literature, Luther and Erasmus. And so you have the first round is Augustine and Pelagius. The second round becomes Luther and Erasmus. And the next round is going to be John Calvin and Arminius. And so you're going to have these, as it were, three different go-rounds over this doctrine, and it's continued to this very day. Now also involved here is a man named Zwingli, and he lived from 1484 to 1531. And he was a Swiss Protestant reformer, and he was known as the Champion of Zurich. And he helped to found the Reformed Church, and the Reformed Church followed Augustine's doctrine, and so those doctrines of Augustine are termed today as Calvinism. So Zwingli helped to bring Calvinism over into the Reformed Church. So that's what Luther is doing, Zwingli is doing it, and Calvin will do it. And they're all bringing Augustine from the Catholic Church, and I am convinced personally that Augustine was not born again. I just can't even imagine, based on his beliefs and the time really in which he lived, that he was born again. I just don't think he was. Just like I don't think that most of those church fathers contemporary with him were born again either. But But he is looked back on by so many people as a great, great champion of the faith. And I just don't think that was the case. Now, I won't be upset. And if I get to heaven there and see Augustine, I'm not going to be upset by that. I'm not going to say you're not supposed to be here because of what I taught in Evaluation of Sectarian Doctrines and what I said in Unfolding Revelation of God class. I won't be upset in the slightest, but I can't imagine, really, during this time where philosophy is taking such a hold on the church, and there's been a lot of persecution on the church, and so the true Christians at various stages along the way here have had to go underground, and Augustine and these other church fathers are not going underground. They're up right there chit-chatting with all the other leaders and so-called politicians of the day. How could they be given such privileged treatment if they were truly born again, standing up for Jesus Christ? They were members, really, in good standing with the state church as it was developing. And there have not been many state churches that anybody who wants to live for God wants to be in good standing with. It just usually doesn't work out very well. But here they are. They're taking these things of Augustine, and they're carrying it right over. And there's got to be demonic spirits causing this, because these men were brilliant men. These were men of integrity. These were committed men living for God. But they picked up demons in the Roman Catholic Church. And they had demons. They had doctrines of demons, where actual demons had come into them, and then those demons masquerade as their thinking. And that's exactly what has to happen. And this is the same thing that has happened to us at various times, where we have thinking that later we find out was demons. This thinking was demons. But the whole time, we thought it was us. It seemed like us. It sounded like us. It felt like us. And then later, as somebody is able to really show us what the truth is, and we start to get a hold of the truth, and we realize who we are as sons of God, as daughters of God, we start to say, now, wait a minute. And our eyes start to get opened. We start to realize, that's not me. That's not my thinking. Those aren't my concepts. And you start to rebuke that thing, start to really go after it. Before too long, you find it's actually gone. And that's what's involved in this. As far as I can tell, that's the only thing that really explains it. I hear people say, I just don't understand how this could be. I have no problem seeing how it could be because of demonic spirits. But without the right understanding on demonic spirits, I would say the same thing. I don't understand how anybody could believe this. But demonic spirits really help to explain what's going on. And it isn't just demonic spirits 100%. There's maybe certain flaws in their own thinking as well, in their own carnal nature, and certain appetites they've developed by being in certain systems and whatever else. But I think primarily we're talking about demonic spirits. Well, we'll talk about John Calvin next. Take a break and we'll talk about John. Dear Brother John.
Pulled it off well.